Today is June 5th, and it's Tuesday morning at Akiba. We're learning Parshat HaShavua, Parshat Bahalotcha. And we're going to open up to the Parsha just to see an overview of it, just see where it is. So we're in the third Torah portion of the Book of Numbers.
If I need it, I'll ask.
And I have one also. Which is chapters 8 to 12. In the third Torah portion of the Book of Numbers. And what this Torah portion talks about are two related things. Number one, it talks about the preparations of the Israelites to start traveling towards the land of Israel. They're now encamped at the base of Mount Sinai, where they've been for 11 and a half months. This first thing, therefore, is the beginning of the preparations for the journey. And the second thing is the beginning of the journey itself. That's the whole Torah portion. Now, what I want to do for the next 5 minutes is simply remind us exactly where we are in time. In a broad picture of what happened since the Israelites left Egypt. So, to make a long story short, we remember that they were in Egypt for 210 years approximately, as slaves I mean. And towards the end of that period, we know that Moshe Rabbeinu came on the scene. He was sent by God, who met him at the burning bush. God sent him to take the mantle of leadership upon himself and to take the Israelites out of Egypt, which he did after 10 plagues and signs and wonders. And we have the 10th plague, the plague of the firstborn, and the Seder night when they left on the 15th of the first month, like the 15th of Nisan. And according to the Torah, that month when they left becomes the first month. It's been called the first month. It took them about 43 or 44 days to get from Egypt to Mount Sinai. About 44 days, 43 days. They stayed at Mount Sinai for about 6 or 7 days, and then the Torah was given. And that's the holiday we just celebrated last week. That was altogether 50 days from the Exodus to the giving of the Torah. So when the Torah is given, what we mean is the Ten Commandments were given with great fanfare and pomp and circumstance and the orchestra playing, the orchestra of heaven playing, of course, thunder and lightning. And then the story says that Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Luchot, the tablets. He's up there for 40 days and 40 nights learning everything he has to learn. And when he's about to come down, God tells him something serious is happening at the base of the mountain. Moses comes down and finds the golden calf. He breaks the tablets, he admonishes the people, he punishes them, and he says, "You guys have to repent, and I will ask God to forgive you." He goes up to the mountain for another 40 days and asks for forgiveness. And then, according to the way the rabbis understand the story, he comes down and goes up again, such that he was there 40 days before the golden calf and 80 days after the golden calf, for a grand total of 120. Now, if you do the mathematics, if he went up 50 days after leaving Egypt, that is to say the holiday that we call Shavuot, and he was there 120, which is 40 times 3, then he came down on Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. He came down on Yom Kippur and brought to the people atonement. He brought to the people the word of God that they've been forgiven. And the second tablets that he brought then were the sign of the fact that God has forgiven the people, and the first tablets now being replaced by the second tablets. Okay, so that's the chronology. Good morning, Ilan.
Good morning.
So, it's now the day after Yom Kippur. And the Israelites start doing the commandments that Moses just brought them from on high. The major commandment was the building of the tabernacle. And now for the whole fall and winter and spring, for the next 6 months, the Israelites are still at Mount Sinai. Still at Mount Sinai. And they're involved in the construction of the tabernacle. The whole fall, winter, and spring. They finish the tabernacle, they finish building the tabernacle approximately the last day of the 12th month of the year, Adar. In other words, the next day, the time to consecrate it, is the first day of Nisan, the first day of the first month of the year, which means that since they left Egypt, until the tabernacle is finished, is 12 months minus 2 weeks, because they left the 15th of Nisan, and now it's the 1st of Nisan, 11 and a half months have passed. So that's the chronology, and they're still remembered at Mount Sinai. They haven't moved. So they've been there basically for 11 and a half months at Mount Sinai. The truth, they'd really been there 10 months because they were traveling for the first 50 days from Egypt to Mount Sinai. So they've been there about 10 and a half months, and now the tabernacle is finished. That's what goes on in the second half of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and the first third of Numbers. Let me be more specific. In the second half of Exodus, when Moses comes down from the mountain after being there altogether 120 days, Yom Kippur brings the tablets, that's the 33rd chapter of Exodus. The rest of the book is all about the construction of the tabernacle, and that's why the second half of Exodus is so boring. It's just about the construction of the tabernacle. They did this, and they did that, and they did this, and they did that, they did this, and that, they did... The very, very, very last few verses of Exodus says they finished the tabernacle, which means that the last few verses of Exodus are really, if they finish the tabernacle, the first day of Nisan after 11 and a half months since the Exodus. Okay? Now, the book of Leviticus has no chronology, no history. It's all laws. No time passes in the book of Leviticus. So just like the beginning of Leviticus, it's the day they finished the tabernacle, the first of Nisan, the end of Leviticus is the same day. No time has passed. It's a book of laws. It's not a book of history, with one exception. There's really one and a half exceptions, not important. The major exception is that the book of Leviticus does have one story in it, the story of the consecration of the tabernacle, which presumably began on the first day of Nisan, again 11 and a half months after they left Egypt. Which means the following, that just like the end of Exodus says they finished the tabernacle, so in the middle of Leviticus there's a story with the finishing of the tabernacle and its consecration. So that same day is discussed twice from two different perspectives, the end of Exodus and also in the book of Leviticus. Then we get to Numbers. At the beginning of the book of Numbers, it is the beginning of the second year. Or it's Nisan, the second year. It's the first 2 months. It's the story of what happened during those first 2 months when they're still at Mount Sinai and they're preparing for the beginning of the journey. One of the things described in last week's Torah portion, Parshat Naso, the second Torah portion of the book of Numbers, when they're still at Mount Sinai, is the consecration of the tabernacle. In other words, it's described a third time. From a third perspective, it's described the end of Exodus, the middle of Leviticus, and now the beginning of Numbers, a different perspective, a different aspect of what happened during the consecration ceremony. And again, we're all talking about the same time. It's still, they haven't moved. From the end of Exodus, all of Leviticus, the beginning of Numbers, they're still there at Mount Sinai, and time has not passed.
Wow.
Okay. So that's an important thing to remember, getting straight how the Torah is organized here. It's organized thematically and not necessarily chronologically. The same event is described three different times in three different books from three different perspectives. And that brings us to this week's Torah portion, again, the third Torah portion of the book of Numbers. And they're still right there at Mount Sinai, right after they did this ceremony of the consecration, which was on the beginning, or at the beginning of the month of Nisan, after 11 and a half months have passed since the Exodus. And everything I just said is the first page of the sheet. I just summarized what I summarized. And now we'll begin study for today. It's the top of the back side of the sheet, B. We're in chapter 10, verses 29 to 36. And this is right smack in the middle of this week's Torah portion. 10:29 to 36.
Numbers is...
Bamidbar.
Bamidbar.
Perek Yud, Pasuk Haftet.
Oh, now I see.
So it says as follows, at the place, more or less. Moshe said to Chovav, son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. Chapter 10, verse 29.
No, chapter 10.
Okay. So first I want to point out, it's a bit confusing, because it says here that Moses' father-in-law is called Chovav, whereas in the book of Exodus he has a different name. Actually, he has two names. There he's called either Yeter or Yitro. Now he's called Chovav. He's also sometimes called Reuel, whereas here Reuel is the name of
his father. Yeah.
So it's a bit of a mix-up. The Talmud says he had seven names, but we know it is Moses' father-in-law. It says as follows. Moses said to Chovav, son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord has said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will be generous with you, for the Lord has promised to be generous to Israel. I will not go, he replied, but will return to my native land. He said, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide. So if you come with us, we will extend to you the same bounty that the Lord grants us. So it's pretty straightforward what's happening. Apparently Moses' father-in-law has been encamped with the Israelites at Mount Sinai. It doesn't say for how long, but he's been with them apparently. And now that the Israelites have gotten word from God that they're about to, after 11 and a half months, start the journey from Mount Sinai to the land of Israel, which is supposed to take them 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 days. So Moses says, come with us. And his father says, no.
I will give it to you. I will give it to you.
Where do you see that?
Verse 29. We're setting out for the place of which the Lord has said.
I will give it to you.
The Lord has said.
The God has said that I will give to you, to the Israelites, the land of Israel.
Okay.
So anyway, what's not clear here is not only how long has Moses' father-in-law been with them, but more to the point, it's not clear what finally happens in the end.
Didn't he bring Tzipora at one point?
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
We're going to get to that. So Moses says, please come with us. His father-in-law says, no, I'll return to my native land. Moses says, please come with us. And his father-in-law says, nothing. So we don't know in the end if he was adamant that I'm going home, or if he agreed, acquiesced to Moses' request. We just don't know. It doesn't say. But we'll get back to that again and again in the next few minutes.
So he's not a convert, considered a convert to Judaism.
Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit also. It depends what you mean. There is no formal celebration or ceremony of conversion at that time.
He's going to go back to his people.
If he goes back to his people, then certainly he's not in any sense a naturalized citizen. If he comes with them, that might be a different story. But we don't know from here if he came or didn't come.
Isn't he a priest for the Midianites?
We learned in the book of Exodus he was a Kohen of idolatry. He was a priest of idolatry. Of course, he could have changed his mind.
At that time.
Right? And the Midrash actually has discussions of what type of spiritual metamorphosis a Yeter or Yitro might have undergone. I just want to parenthetically say a very meaningful Devar Torah that I heard 30 years ago from a Rav in Israel, the name of Rav Dov Bigon, who is the founder of an institution called Machon Meir, the Meir Institute. He said the following in this parsha. I still remember how he said it, because he said it with such love and such warmth. He asked the following question. Again, this is parenthetical. It's not our subject, but since we're here. He said, look, we know from the verses again and again and again that God is guiding the Israelites to the land. There's the cloud in the daytime. There's the pillar of fire at night.
Why does he need Yitro?
Why does he need Yitro? What is Moses saying? We need you as a guide. You know the wilderness. You've lived here your whole life. You have a tradition from your family. You know everything. What do we need that for? Says Rav Dov Bigon, if God is the guide. So
he's polite to his father-in-law.
Rav Bigon said something else. He said that Moses understands that God is such a good guide, and God will help them to avoid all the pitfalls of the desert so that they'll never know the dangers they're avoiding. They need someone to tell them not where to go, but
the reality.
Why they went the way they went.
Yeah.
They'll go through the desert. Everything will seem very nice. They need Yitro to say, it must be God. Didn't God you there? Because there's quicksand. Didn't God you there? Because there's scorpions. Didn't God you there? Because there's the terrible sandstorms. They need a guide to make them more aware of the wonderful blessings and the compassion and the loving kindness of God.
What was his name?
Rav Dov Bigon. He's the Rosh Hashiva of Mechon Meir. He's now in his 70s. So anyway, he was one of the very first Balei Tshuva after the war in 1967.
Wow.
He began a whole movement, whole story. So Rav Dov Bigon just concluded and said that we all need not only to experience blessings in life, but to know that we're experiencing blessings.
That might be why he said, "Ve'italanu le'inayim."
Yeah, the real inayim are spiritual inayim. Spiritualize. Mm-hmm. They needed Yitro to spiritualize to make them aware of the blessings of God. And with that, we'll close parentheses and we'll go back to the chronology that we're talking about. So, here we are, the chronology. So in order to... There's a lot of things we have to understand here. Mm-hmm. We want to ask ourselves, again, did Chovav come with them or not come with them? It doesn't say from here. How did he get to Mount Sinai to be with them? It also doesn't say. Well, I'm going to have to fit this story into other stories to see the fuller picture, and we'll do that in just about a few seconds. So, to begin seeing the whole story, we're going to now go to chapter 12, verses 1 to 13. Something else in this week's Torah portion. We'll come back and put everything together. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 13. When they were in Hatzirot, which means they began their journey from Mount Sinai, in this week's Torah portion, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moshe because of the Cushite woman he had married. He married a Cushite woman. They said, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moshe? Has he not spoken through us as well?" In other words, it's not clear exactly what they have against Moshe, but what they're saying is, why does he get special privileges? Has the Lord spoken only to him? The Lord heard it. Now Moses was a very humble man, more so than any other man on earth. Suddenly the Lord called to Moshe, "Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tent of meeting, to the Ohel Moed." So the three of them went out. The Lord came down, a pillar of cloud stopped at the entrance of the tent and called out, "Aaron and Miriam." The two of them came forward and he said, "Hear these my words. When a prophet of the Lord arises among you, I make myself known to him in a vision, I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moshe. He is trusted throughout my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, plainly and not in riddles, and he beholds the likeness of the Lord." In other words, he's on a higher level than either other prophets. "How then did you not shrink from speaking against my servant Moshe?" Still incensed with them, the Lord departed. As the cloud withdrew from the tent, there was Miriam stricken with snow-white scales. When Aaron turned toward Miriam, he saw that she was stricken with scales. And Aaron said to Moses, "O my Lord, account not to us the sin which we committed in our folly. Let her not be as one dead who emerges from his mother's womb with half his flesh eaten away." So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "O God, pray heal her."
It's interesting that Aharon is not punished.
Right, there's a lot to talk about here.
Maybe it's coming here.
No, it's not. He's not punished and Miriam is. Mm-hmm. And also exactly what did God say about the level of Moses' prophecy, all that we're not going to talk about. We're going to talk basically just about the first verse of the chapter.
Who was this Cushite woman?
Yeah. Isha Cushite. So, on the question of who the Cushite woman is, there's really not a big controversy. There's not. There's one commentator in the Middle Ages Ibn Kasfi, his name is, who claims that this is a second wife that Moses took over and above his wife Zipporah.
That's what I thought.
But almost all the other commentators in all the Midrash say that this is Zipporah. She's a Cushite woman. How could she be a Cushite woman? We thought she was a Midianite woman. The answer might be in the verses from the book of Habakkuk that I brought here, which seem to imply very strongly that Cush and Midian are the same country.
Mm-hmm. It's parallel.
If you see the seventh verse that I brought there, yeah. It's a parallelism, a poetic parallelism. I see the tents of Cushan in affliction, the curtains of the land of Midian do tremble. Mm-hmm. Certainly, geographically, they're right next to each other, and they might be the same thing. When we talk about Cush, it's modern-day Ethiopia. Cush means black. Modern-day Ethiopia, probably including part of what today is Egypt. In other words, not just not just where Ethiopia is today, but also going north and going east. It might even include parts of what today is Saudi Arabia and the Sinai Peninsula. That whole area seems to be the area of Cush / Midian.
And where is Midian?
Same thing.
Midian is kind of Saudi Arabia?
Could it be possible that one spouse was Midian and the other spouse was Cush? So she's mixed.
Could be, but... the assumption is that it's the same thing. And Midian, yes, Midian is part of Saudi Arabia, the parts that are close to the Sinai Peninsula, and perhaps also parts of Sinai and parts of the African continent that is there on the coast of the Gulf of Suez. Midian, Cush, Mitzrayim, Egypt.
So haven't the Muslims gotten this idea that he's married to a potential ancestor of Muhammad.
Okay, great. It's all in the family. We're all related. We're all Semites.
Anyway.
Right. So, now that we understand that the woman being discussed is probably Miriam, the big question, of course, is what is the complaint of Miriam?
That
did I say something correct?
What is the complaint of Aaron
and Miriam?
Right. Given that we know the Cushite woman is
Zipporah,
what's the complaint of Miriam and Aaron against Moshe for marrying Zipporah?
And what is this twice lakach?
Yeah, that's also a question. I don't have anything to say about that.
The structure of the verse is so strange.
That's why in English they translate it as a quote, he married a Cushite woman. That's what Miriam and Aaron said. Anyway, just let me get back to the strain of thought here.
And why is it connected with the rebellion against Moshe?
Well, what's their complaint?
Yes.
Like, why are they against Moshe? Because of his marriage. The issue is not only what they have against Zipporah, but it's deeper. Moses has been married to Zipporah for the past 60 years.
60?
After 60 years of marriage, why are they getting upset? Let me remind you of the chronology. Moses, we'll do that in a second. So the first question is, why are they upset with Zipporah, with Moses marrying Zipporah, but why now, after 60 years? 60 years of marriage.
And when did this scene of Chatan Tamim happen?
We'll get to that also.
Okay.
Now, Chazal, probably because of these two questions, what issue do Miriam and Aaron have against Zipporah, and why now? Probably because of those two issues, Chazal understood this verse completely differently. That even though it says that they're upset because Moses married a Cushite woman who's Zipporah, Chazal understand it as meaning almost the opposite. They are upset with Moshe for divorcing Zipporah. And you might say, where does it say he divorced her? It doesn't say.
No, but we have Yitro coming. Achar Shiluchea.
We'll get to that also.
Yeah.
So Chazal add a whole story into this story. And they say that Miriam and Aaron got word of the fact that Moses had divorced his wife, and they were defending Zipporah. Why did you divorce her? And we won't go into all the mechanics of the story. It's quite complicated because I want to go in a completely different direction. I want to try and understand the verses according to their pshat. There's no mention of divorce, so we're not going to talk about divorce. We're going to talk about marriage. And then the question will be, what do Miriam and Aaron have against Moses' marriage to Zipporah? And why are they bringing up their objections now, 60 years after the chuppah? That's the question we'll talk about for the next half an hour.
Maybe in Sinai we're told not to marry foreign women?
Yes, it may very well be related to that. But still the question has to be, why did it take them 60 years to complain?
Well,
and let's talk now about those 60 years. How did 60 years pass?
They weren't aware that was an issue.
They just got all the
but
laws.
All these things
will come into it. Yeah.
So his father-in-law was definitely the father of Zipporah, not the Cushite woman.
It's the same thing.
Same woman.
The same thing.
Well, but the possibility that it wasn't, that he divorced. If he divorced Zipporah and married a Cushite woman, right?
No,
now you're combining two things.
Okay.
You're
combining
two different approaches.
You're having a party now.
But let's try and go straightforwardly. So to figure all this out, we're going to go back to the book of Exodus to see the original development of the character of Moshe and the marriage with Zipporah and everything that happened afterwards. So back to the book of Exodus, the very beginning, chapter 2. Chapter 2 of the book of Exodus. So Moses, you remember, grew up in the palace of Paro, didn't have too much connection with his brethren, the Israelites. But then when he was a young man, he went out of the palace to see how his brethren are doing. And we read in chapter 2, verse 15, that after Moses killed a taskmaster, when he saw this taskmaster afflicting an Israelite slave, well, the following is written in chapter 2, verse 15. Everyone has a place? Chapter 2, verse 15. I'm going to tell...
On page 324.
Okay.
The fellow wants to kill him.
Verse 15. Okay. When Paro learned of the matter, that Moses had killed this Egyptian, he sought to kill Moshe, but Moses fled from Paro. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. Moses is someplace between the age of 15 and 20, let's say, a young man. Now the priest of Midian, that's Kohen Midian, had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds came and drove them off. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he's called Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why did you leave the man? Ask him to come in and break bread." Moses consented to stay with the man. In other words, they invited him for a meal, and he stayed for another meal, and he stayed for another meal, and he stayed for a long time. And gave Moses his daughter Zipporah as wife. She bore a son whom he named Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." So Moses, at the age of 15 or 20, goes to a foreign land, to Midian, and he gets married there to Zipporah, the daughter of Reuel, and he stays for a while?
A non-Jewish person.
Of course, at that point, there's no Torah, there's no Judaism, there's no mitzvot.
There's no Judaism.
All there is one more sentence, is a memory of a covenant with Abraham that consisted of circumcision and a promise for the future, but not yet has anything happened.
But we have already by then a tradition of marrying within the family and of being very upset with foreign wives.
Perhaps. Jan is referring to the fact that Abraham married someone from his own clan, and Yitzhak married someone from the same clan back in the old country, and Yaakov also married someone from the same clan back in the old country. As far as the sons of Yaakov, we don't know who they married.
No, right? But we have Esav. And
Esav, who married a Canaanite woman, his parents got very, extremely upset with him. That's true. We don't know if the issue is marrying a foreigner or specifically marrying a Canaanite woman.
That's true.
We don't know. And again, who the children of Jacob married, we don't know. And how much intermarriage there was in Egypt, we don't know.
Well, it could be in Egypt. Because they were slaves, they had to marry
among themselves. Well, yeah, who is Moses going to marry? Remember, he grew up not among the slaves. He grew up in the palace as an Egyptian. Now he's a Midianite, living in Midian. Who else is he going to marry? It's hard to fault him for marrying what's available.
And also Yosef marries an
Egyptian woman. Egyptian. Right?
So also a daughter of a priest.
That's also true. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So does Gershom mean a stranger?
Yeah, it means Gershom. Stranger there. Exactly, that's what it means.
Of course, that's our George.
My father's Hebrew name.
Uh-huh. Really?
So, let's go back to the story, and let's pick it up in the verses that follows. After this, a long time passes, and Moses is in the desert, shepherding his flocks, and he finds the burning bush. God talks to him, says, please take upon yourself the mantle of leadership. Serve as a leader of the Israelites, take them out of Egypt. Moses says no. God says yes, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. At the end of the burning bush, it looks like Moses accepts the mantle of leadership. How do I know that he accepts it? Because look at chapter 4, verse 18.
335.
Okay, thank you.
Chapter 4, verse 18. Now, what we're reading right now, right after the burning bush, I know that Moses is 80 years old. Because the verses say that he went back to Egypt at the age of 80 to become the leader. Verse 18, Moses went back to his father-in-law, Yeter, and said to him, let me go back to my kinsmen in Egypt and see how they are faring. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And again, Moses now is 80. He's been about 60 years in Midian, married to Zipporah. How do I know that he's 80? Well, it says it. And also remember that after 40 years in the desert, he was 120 and he died. So 120 when he died, 40 years in the desert means 80 when they left Egypt. Mm. He was 80, approximately. Now let's read verse 24 in the same chapter 4. So Moses is on his way to Egypt with his wife and children. Verse 24, at a night encampment on the way, the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. Those are pretty powerful and strange verses. God tries to kill Moses, doesn't say how or where or why. So Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his legs with it, saying, you are truly a bridegroom of blood to me.
And the son?
It doesn't say. It doesn't say if she's talking to the boy or talking to her husband. It doesn't say. Not clear.
And to whose feet?
Doesn't say.
Yeah.
Doesn't say. And when he let him alone, the he is clear that it's God letting Moses alone, she added a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. The translation is unclear. The meaning is unclear. Everything is unclear. And we could spend a whole hour on these verses, but we're not. We're just going to talk about what is clear. What is clear is that Zipporah has heard of this ritual of circumcision. She knows what it is. And when God is terribly upset with Moshe, she understands that circumcision can solve the issue. So therefore, she knows that circumcision has something to do with Moses' relationship to his God.
So we have a woman Moed.
Absolutely. And when she circumcises the child, it turns out that she was right. That's what God got angry, apparently, because then God relents and saves Moshe. So if you put that all together, it means that Zipporah has some sense of identification with the religious tradition of Moses' family. Moses himself, of course, probably wasn't that aware, because he was 60 years in Midian, before that growing up at the palace of Egypt, not too much contact with his family. But apparently Moses had passed on to his wife, told his wife about his Israelite roots. She knew something about circumcision, something about the covenant with Abraham, something about the fact that circumcision is connected to God and Abraham and to a tradition. And then when a terrible moment, we don't know why or how, terrible moment comes and God is upset with Moshe, she understands that the key to repairing the relationship with God is circumcision. That much is clear. A lot of things aren't clear, but that much is clear.
The boy must have been very old, too.
We don't know. We don't know. I understand you're saying that Moses is 80.
Right.
I know, a lot of things are unclear.
Yeah.
But anyway, taking it at face value, this means that Tzipora had some sense of Jewish identity.
Right.
And was willing to take a leap of action to express that Jewish identity in her family. Being that at this time, there's no Judaism, and there's no mitzvot, and there's no conversion ceremony, being that she did what she did, I would say that's the best way possible to express some type of connection with Moses and the nascent Judaism. It's as if she converted. Again, there's no Judaism, there's no conversion, no mitzvot. But what she did is the most powerful thing. As we know, circumcision turns out to be, in later Jewish law, the essence of conversion. Now, she can't become circumcised, but as a circumciser, that's pretty close to doing what you have to do to take upon yourself some type of Jewish identity and some type of connection to the historical destiny of the Jewish people. That much seems to be clear. That's Moshe and Tzipora. So she's not Jewish, but she's somehow connected to the destiny of the Jewish people. With that information, let's go on now, reading further.
And we still don't know whether the circumcision was of Moses or of
his
Gershon.
It seems like it's the son. Cuts off her son's foreskin, but what she did with the foreskin, touched whose legs with it, was it Moses or the baby? That's not clear. I tend to think it's Moses, but it doesn't, certainly not clear. So now, we're turning on the sheets that I prepared.
But Moses' mother had a lot of access to him, and she might have circumcised him too.
Could be, might be not, we don't know. We don't know.
Well, it could have been that he, before he was put in the basket.
That's true.
Yeah. Could be.
Oh, yeah.
So now, it looks like Tzipora and Moses and the child, and perhaps another child, are on their way to Egypt to take the Jews out of slavery, right? And we're going to just remind ourselves that there were the 10 plagues, and Moses is leading the Jewish people, and then there's the plague of the firstborn, and then they get out, and then there's the splitting of the Red Sea, and then they travel for 45 days and get to Mount Sinai. Let's read about Mount Sinai. I'm going to chapter 18.
Exodus.
So we're going to see something that Ilana hinted to 5 minutes ago. Something extremely strange. So, yes. Moses and the people are encamped at Mount Sinai. They've left Egypt. God is about to give the Torah to the Israelites. And it says at the beginning of chapter 18 the following.
Verse 32.
Chapter 18, verse 1. Yitro, priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moshe and for Israel, his people. How the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, took Tzipora, Moses' wife, after she had been sent home, and her two sons, of whom one was named this, one was named that, and I'll get to the end of verse 5. Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, brought Moses' sons and wives to him, in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God at Mount Sinai. So this is really strange. And Ilana mentioned earlier, Ahar Shiluchea. After she was sent.
Is not divorced?
Right now we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So what's going on? This is really strange. Because we just read that in Moses' journey from Midian to Egypt, he took Tzipora and she was there. She was in the hotel. She did the circumcision. Moses was there in Egypt with the Israelites for about a year, the 10 plagues, the whole thing. They leave Egypt, get to Mount Sinai, and suddenly Tzipor's not there. Rather, she has to come later with her father-in-law. So something is missing here. Something's missing. It says that Moses had sent her away, but when did that happen? So about the sending her away, we have to figure out what's going on. For that, we go to the Midrash. And this is an ancient Midrash, the Mechilta, on the book of Exodus, written about 2,000 years ago. And we're going to see how it's quoted by Rashi in his interpretation, in his commentary on the Chumash. So I brought the Rashi on the last page of the handout. It looks like this. This is Rashi's paraphrase of the Mechilta. And it's on those words that we just read, Achar Shiluheya, after his having sent her away, having sent her home. Top left-hand side. When God said to him in Midian, go return to Egypt, and Moses took his wife and his sons, etc., and returned to Egypt. And Aaron went forth toward him and met him at the mount of God. So what that means is Moses is on his way from Midian to Egypt with his family. And as he's on his way to Egypt, Aaron is told by God, Moses is on his way, go and meet him. And they meet up at a place called Mount Sinai. This is before the Ten Commandments, this is before the Ten Plagues, before Moses gets to Egypt. And look what the Midrash says went on between the two brothers when they met. Aaron said to him, who are these? Aaron is referring to the family. Mm-hmm. He answered him, this is my wife, whom I married in Midian, and these are my children. He thereupon asked him, whither are you taking them? He replied, to Egypt. Whereupon he said to him, we have cause to grieve over the former ones, and you propose to add to their number? Moses therefore said to her, return to your father's house. She took her two sons and went away. So according to what the Midrash quoted by Rashi says, Aaron says to Moses, look, the Israelites are slaves in Egypt. It's a war zone there. And you're coming with a divine mission to take them out of Egypt. There's going to be blood. There's going to be bloodshed. There's going to be conflict. Why do you want to bring your family into that? Send them home. And Moses sent them home. Makes sense. And then, after the whole story, after the 10 plagues, after the Exodus, after the splitting of the Red Sea, when the Israelites get to Mount Sinai, so then Moses' father-in-law brings Moses' wife and two kids back to reunite with the family. It all makes sense. It all makes sense. There's nothing too difficult here. Okay? Just getting the chronology right. Now, back to where we were. I'm just going to turn the pages.
That's if you accept that premise.
But it seems to make perfect
sense.
Because the verse does say that Yitro brought the wife and kids after Moses has sent them away. It seems to make a lot of sense. If there are other ways of looking at it, I don't know. So now, we are going to read on in these verses here in Exodus.
This is before the Mishnah, right?
The Mechilta is from the same period as the Mishnah.
Because the language is similar to the Mishnah language.
Same period.
Yeah.
It's the time of the Tanaim. So now we're going to continue reading on in Exodus 18. So we read that Yitro is on his way with the wife and kids. Verse 6 in chapter 18. 18:6. He sent word to Moshe, I, your father-in-law Yitro, are coming to you with your wife and your two sons. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. He bowed low and kissed him. Each asked about the other's welfare, and they went into the tent. Moses then recounted to his father-in-law everything that the Lord had done to Paro and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardships that had befallen them on the way. Now the Lord had delivered them. And Yitro rejoiced over all the kindness that the Lord had shown Israel when he delivered them from the Egyptians. Blessed be the Lord, Yitro said, who delivered you from the Egyptians and from Paro, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, yes, by the result of their very schemes against the people. And Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to partake of the meal before God with Moses' father-in-law. Next day, Moses sat as magistrate among the people, while the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. But when Moses' father-in-law saw, etc., etc., if you remember the story, Moses is judging the people from morning to evening, and he's doing it all alone. His father-in-law says, how can you do this? The people are waiting all day, they're on their feet, you're on your feet, you need to appoint assistants, magistrates. And Moses takes his father-in-law advice, and the whole chapter describes that. And then at the end of chapter 18, we're going to read one verse, verse 27. Verse 27. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way to his own land. Do you see that verse?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So now we have to ask ourselves, what's the relationship between the events described here in Exodus and the events described in Numbers that we read half an hour ago? Because in Numbers we saw that the father-in-law was there at Mount Sinai. Moses said, we're going to Israel, please come. Father-in-law says no. Moses says yes. We don't know what happened at the end. Here, we're at Mount Sinai now. It's the same Mount Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
It is 11 months earlier. And we read that Zipporah is brought with her father-in-law. Moses says hello to his father-in-law, says hello to his wife. They have a lot of conversation we just read about. The father-in-law stays for a while, helps Moses to arrange the administration of the people, and then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell and he went his way to his own land. So what's going on? If we take everything at face value, it means Yitro came and left here in Exodus, and then 10 months later, 11 months later, he must have come again. And then when Moses said, we're going to the promised land, we don't know if he stayed or went with them. That's possible. If you read it, that means reading it chronologically. Mm-hmm. That the father-in-law came and left, came again, and we don't know if he left. But why is that problematic? It's problematic because it never says that he came again. We just know he was there. Never says that he got there. And therefore, we should probably not read this as two separate accounts, but it's one account written in two different places. What that means is the following, that here we read that when the Israelites get to Mount Sinai, Yitro comes with the daughter and the two grandchildren. But when the verse says that Moses bade his father-in-law farewell and he went his way to his own land, that's true, but it doesn't mean it happened now. Rather, that's the end of the story. He eventually left. But when did he leave? Only 10 months later. How do I know he stayed for 10 months? Because 10 months later, he's described as still being there. It's not that he left and came back. He was always there. And why doesn't it say in Numbers what Yitro eventually did in the end, whether he left or stayed? It doesn't say, because it says it here. In other words, what it gives you here is the bookends of the story. Since the story begins being told, it tells you what's going to happen in the end. But that end didn't happen until 10 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So the result of the whole thing is that Yitro came with Zipporah and with the two children, and he stayed for 10 months. At the end of 10 months, Moses says, we're out of here. God's taking us to the land of Israel. Yitro said, I don't want to come. Moses said, please come. And his reaction was to leave and go to his own land, as it says, Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way to his own land. And this is not the only place in the Torah in which things are written in this fashion, that the same event is described in different places, and you have to piece it together, because the Torah is written thematically, not chronologically. Now, you might say this is an interesting history lesson, but why is it important? It's very important, because the chronology and history we just pieced together is going to help us answer the original question we asked of why did Aaron and Miriam get so upset with Moses 60 years after the marriage began. We just found the answer. Just have to put everything together and explain how it works. So the answer, I think, is as follows. We're ready?
Yes.
We're ready. So it's true that Moses married Zipporah years ago, 60 years ago, when he was in his late teens or his 20s. But of course he married her in Midian, and no Israelite knew about it. That's fine. 60 years pass, approximately 59, let's say. Moses is called upon by God to go back to Egypt and take the Israelites out from slavery to freedom. We read about that. Moses takes his wife and children. He's about to bring them to Egypt, and someone stops him and says, they're not coming with you. That was Aaron. Right? According to the Midrash we read, Aaron says, it's not worth it. You can't do it. Don't bring your wife and children into a war zone. Moses sends them back to Egypt. Which means at this point, the only person who's met Zipporah of all the Jews is Aaron. And as far as he knows, Moses sent her away. Fine. So now, 10 plagues, the plague of the firstborn, the Exodus, the Red Sea, the Israelites with Moses get to Mount Sinai, and no one knows that the 80-year-old Moses is married, except for Aaron. Right? Moses has been a solitary leader, a man of God, devoted to the Jewish people, without any family, without any worries. He's just the mentor and the guide of the Jewish people. Okay? And that, of course, is a certain image of an angelic man. And then they're at Mount Sinai, and this guy, Yitro, shows up with a woman and two children. And everyone learns,
You mean they're 60 years old? They're not children anymore.
But
it's,
whatever.
It's children.
So everyone sees that Moses has a wife. Not exactly. Everyone does not see that Moses has a wife. Because when this entourage comes to meet Moshe, who's at the head of it? Yitro. Not the woman. Yitro's at the head of this entourage. And from all we read, Moses' interaction with the entourage is with Yitro. The woman stays in the tent. Moses has a very beautiful relationship, as we read, with Yitro. They talk, they offer sacrifices, they learn Torah together. Moses tells them everything that God did. And then Moses goes to judge the people, and Yitro is there, advising Moses what to do. My point is that for the 10 months that Yitro and Zipporah and the kids are at Mount Sinai together with Moshe, no one perceives Zipporah as Moses' wife. She's just part of this entourage that came to meet Moses. When will the people perceive directly, face to face, that Moses has a wife? When Yitro leaves and she remains. Nice. That's when they'll realize that they have a leader who has a wife and children. Until then, what they see is Yitro. Which means in this week's Torah portion, when the Israelites are about to move from Mount Sinai forward, what happens, as we read, Moses says to his father-in-law, we're going, please come. Father-in-law says no. Moses says yes. The father-in-law decides to go back to his land. Where was that? That was in Numbers chapter 10, right? Mm-hmm. And then the next chapter is 11. Let's skip that for a second. Chapter 12, just the very next chapter, is where Aaron and Miriam revolt against Moses and say, you married a Cushite woman. Our question was, why did they revolt then, 60 years after the marriage? The answer is, because only right now does the Am come face to face with the realization that this woman is staying. Mm-hmm. She's not going back with her father-in-law. She's really Moses' wife. And now, here is Moses married to a Cushite woman. Now, why is it so bad? Everyone gets to be married. Moses also can be married. What's so wrong with having a wife? Because she's a Cushite woman. So what's wrong with a Cushite woman? You say, what's wrong with a Cushite woman? You ready? Now we're going to see a number of sources. Which one should we begin with? Okay, let's begin with the following. I'm going to my last page here, basically. Let's begin with the following. Everyone remembers, we're a few minutes over time, I'll try to go quickly. Everyone remembers, I hope, the class we had on the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb of the Seder ceremony,
mm-hmm.
2 or 3 months ago. To make a long story short, we had shown that the lamb was one of the gods worshipped by the Egyptians, mm-hmm. and the commandment of the Israelites to sacrifice that lamb was an act of civil disobedience. Because if you remember, we had shown from verses in the prophets that the Israelites were idolaters together with the Egyptians. They had sunk to assimilation and acculturalization. They had lost any type of Jewish identity that they might have had. They were acting just like the Egyptians. That's written in the prophet. And then God says, if you want to be redeemed, you have to repudiate, at least to a certain degree, that Egyptian culture that you've become part of. You have to sacrifice the God that the Egyptians and you have been worshipping. And that's why you're supposed to do it on your front lawn, make a big show of it, make a big bonfire with a lot of smoke and a lot of smell, and then take the blood and smear it on the doorpost so everyone sees what you did. And that's an act of civil disobedience. It's difficult. It's dangerous to do that in the presence of all the Egyptians. And only those Jews who were able to take upon themselves to do that were redeemed. In other words, part of the redemption was a repudiation from and a distancing from Egyptian worship and culture. And then it turns out that Moses, our leader, is still, in the eyes of the people, mired in that culture. He's married to a foreigner. We all are perhaps married, I assume, to Israelite women. Perhaps some of them were married to foreigners, and it could very well be that those foreign wives stayed in Egypt. The people had to separate from them. And then Moses, it turns out, is married to a foreign woman. It doesn't look good. It's terrible publicity. It's terrible PR. And it's also an essential problem from the point of view of Aaron and Miriam. How can you, Moses, not do what God has demanded of all the people? And there's even more than that. We're going to read this commentary, Tiferet Yonatan. This is a commentary on Rashi. Remember, Rashi is a commentary on the Torah. Mm-hmm. This is a commentary on the commentary. By the way, there's over 100 commentaries on Rashi. And he is commenting on the Rashi that we learned a few minutes ago. The Rashi that tells the story of Moses coming to Egypt with his wife and kids, and Aaron saying, we have enough problems with the Israelites in Egypt being slaves. Don't bring more people into it. Send them home.
So when is that written?
I'm not sure. I didn't look it up. I don't remember. Tiferet Yonatan, we have cause to grieve over the former ones. That's a quote from Rashi. That's what Aaron said. Uh-huh. Just turn it over.
Here.
That's what Aaron had said, remember, to Moses. We have problems with the former ones. You bring us more. This is difficult. I don't understand, says Tiferet Yonatan. What is Aaron saying? For the tribe of Levi was not enslaved. But there's a tradition that the tribe of Levi isn't enslaved in Egypt. So what if Moses brings his wife? Moses is a Levite. They won't be enslaved because he's from the tribe of Levi. And furthermore, in any case, their time of redemption has arrived. So what's the problem with bringing them in? We're all going to be redeemed. So bring them. So what? That's his problem. Why did Aaron, according to Rashi, object to Moses bringing his wife and children? Rather, the claim of Zimri is well known. Uh-oh. What's the claim of Zimri? We don't know. Let's look it up. Chapter 25 of the book of Numbers. Right? And I'm going to drive you crazy.
Wasn't it that all Israel are prophets?
No, that's a different one.
Ah.
That's
Numbers.
That's around Eldad and Medad.
Ah, okay.
Look at the beginning of chapter 25 of the book of Numbers.
Numbers is
Bamidbar.
Yeah, it's 907.
Thank you.
25. This is after they've gone through the whole desert, 40 years, they're encamped at Shittim, which is right at the Jordan River overlooking Jericho. Mm-hmm. When Israel was staying at Shittim, the people profaned themselves by whoring with the Moabite women, who invited the people to the sacrifices for their God. The people partook of them and worshipped their God. Thus Israel attached itself to Baal Peor, and the Lord was incensed with Israel. So at the end of 40 years, the Israelites go head over heels into promiscuity and sexuality and licentiousness and idolatry with the Moabite women and with the gods of Moab. It's called Baal Peor. The Lord said to Moses, take all the ringleaders and have them publicly impaled before the Lord, so that the Lord's wrath may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to Israel's officials, each of you slay those of his men who attach themselves to Baal Peor. Just then, one of the Israelites came and brought a Midianite woman over to his companions. For what purpose? For promiscuity. To show everyone, it's okay, let's not be afraid of Moses' admonishments and rebuke. In the sight of Moses and of the whole Israelite community, who were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting because of the great sins going on. So now you just imagine this. You have someone publicly flaunting Moses' admonishments and bringing one of these Midianite women, remember Midianite, in front of the whole congregation. He's going to show what we can do. He's going to show what we can do in public. When Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he left the assembly and taking a spear in his hand, he followed the Israelite into the chamber and stabbed both of them, the Israelite and the woman, when they're in the course of intercourse, through the belly. Then the plague against the Israelites was checked.
Oh, so Zimri was the sinner.
Ah, so the man's name is Zimri, as we learn later on in verses we won't read. The big question the Midrash will ask is, why did Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, have to get up and do this? Where was Moses? Moses was crying. Moses was upset with the people. But why wasn't Moses taking action? Why was Moses paralyzed so that Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, had to do it?
He's 120 years old. He can hardly move.
The Torah says that lo naslicho. He didn't lose his abilities until the very end of his life. So where was he? Look what the Midrash says where he was. So we're going to now look at this page. This page. Then we'll go back to Tiferet Yonatan. I'm taking you on a trip here, on a journey. Okay. Bottom left-hand side, Babylonian Talmud tractate, Sanhedrin, page 82a.
And they're quoting Tiferet Yonatan.
And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined in Balfour. That's the verse we just read. Okay? The Midrash says, thereupon the tribe of Shimon went unto Zimri ben Salu and said to him, behold, capital punishment is being meted out. In other words, Moses is killing all of us who are acting promiscuously and idolatrously, yet you sit silent. In other words, the tribe of Shimon, they were the instigators of this promiscuity. And they're saying to their leader, defend us against this Moses who's telling us that we shouldn't be doing this. And he's trying to kill us. Defend us. What did he do? What did Zimri do to defend their right to engage in these promiscuous relations? He arose and assembled 24,000 Israelites and went into Cozbi. You'll see who she is. And said unto her, surrender thyself unto me. She's a Midianite princess. She replied, I'm the king's daughter, and thus hath my father instructed me, thou shalt yield only to thy greatest man. I too, he replied, I'm the prince of a tribe. Moreover, my tribe is greater than his, Moses, for mine is second in birth, while his is third. He then seized her by the hair and brought her before Moshe. Again, he's going to rape her in public. Son of Amram, he explained, this is Zimri saying to Moses, is this woman forbidden or permitted to me? And should you say she's forbidden, who permitted thee, Jethro's daughter?
Oh.
How could you, Moses, tell me not to have relations with this Midianite? You're doing the same thing. So according to the Midrash, the fact that Moses is married to a foreigner is causing him problems still at the end of 40 years in the desert, not just the beginning, at the end. And what I'm saying is that if He was having problems with his wife because she's a foreigner, a Midianite. At the end of the 40 years, it could very well be that that's the problem described in our Torah portion, Numbers verse 1 of chapter 12, at the beginning of the 40 years, when Aaron and Miriam say, you married a Cushite woman, because the first time they see him with his wife, perhaps their claim is the same claim that the Midrash is putting in the mouth of Zimri. You see, if Moses is married to a Cushite woman, it destroys the whole moral foundation of the whole Exodus, of the whole enterprise of God, of trying to make of this nation into a unique nation. You're not allowed to be married to foreign women. You have to build a purity of the household. And Moses, the head of the people, is married to a Midianite. How could it be? Now back to Tiferet Yonatan. Okay, back to Tiferet Yonatan. So remember, Tiferet Yonatan now is a commentary on Rashi, and Rashi is commenting on an exchange between Moses and Aaron when Moses originally tried to bring Tzipora to Egypt. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
And we were reading at the end of the second line of Tiferet Yonatan. He's explaining why Aaron had an issue with Tzipora coming to Egypt. Rather, the tribe of Zimri is well known. The claim of Zimri is well known. The daughter of Yitro, who permitted her to you. That's what we just read in the Talmud. And he did not accept that she was a convert for the sake of heaven. Right? Zimri didn't accept that Moses allowed to marry her because she was a convert. He didn't make those type of distinctions. Now in Egypt, the Israelites transgressed the covenant of circumcision. But they did not intermarry with the women of the land.
Mm.
And Aaron was afraid that if Zipporah would enter the land of Egypt and the Israelites would see that Moses took a Midianite woman, they would themselves marry Egyptian women, for they would not be able to make a distinction and divine wrath would come upon them, God forbid. And that is what the Midrash means when it says we have cause to grieve over the former ones. That's what Aaron said to Moses to tell him not to bring Zipporah, that they transgressed the covenant of circumcision. And now in addition, we will have to worry that they will want to marry the women of the land, God forbid. And therefore, he sent her back to Midian. So according to this, the same claim that Zimri makes against Moses, how could you marry a Midianite? That's actually what Aaron was saying to Moses before the whole Exodus. You can't bring it here. It just won't look good. We won't be able to galvanize the people to devote themselves to God if you have skeletons in your closet. So keep her away. So Moses kept her away. But then she came back, as we read, at Mount Sinai. She came with her father. And when her father-in-law left, Aaron and Miriam are left with this public... Aaron and Miriam are left with this public relations debacle that their leader turns out to be married to a Midianite. What are we going to do? And that's why they make their claim against Moses. So the claim is on two levels. It's an essential claim. It's not good. It's not fair. It's not right. You can't be married to her. And if Moses says, but wait a second, she's the most holy woman that could be. She saved my life. She circumcised our son. She's completely converted to Judaism. So then they'll say, Aaron and Miriam, okay, so perhaps in your eyes it's okay. Perhaps in God's eyes it's okay. But what are the people going to say? What are the reporters going to say when they come to interview? What's going to happen? You won't be able to galvanize the people behind you to go with God, leaving everything they have behind, leaving idolatry, leaving their perhaps Egyptian wives, if you yourself are living up to those standards. And you have to not just do the right thing, you have to do what looks like the right thing. And just think of how this relates to so many things going on today. Think of how the press goes after the wives and the spouses of candidates and presidents and, you know, gets into all the past. Sometimes they find things that are really morally repugnant. Sometimes they find things that might have explanation.
And pregnant mistresses.
Yeah. So Moses is in deep trouble. So to make a long story short, that might be the foundation of the problematics of the claim. But God's answer, as you remember, was, how dare you speak against Moses?
Yeah.
And God in the end defends Moses and punishes Miriam and perhaps Aaron.
How Aaron is punished? with his sons?
We don't know.
Does she heal?
Yes, we read that she heals. Perhaps let's end with that. Let's end with her healing. So we're going back to chapter 12.
She's the over 90. She's late in 90s.
Yeah, but still, she was ill. So the end of chapter 12.
And Jethro is in his hundreds already.
And she did so much good too.
So we're reading chapter 12, verse 14. Moses cried to God and said, heal her. Chapter 12, verse 14. But the Lord said to Moshe, if her father spat in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp for 7 days, and then let her be readmitted. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not march on until Miriam was readmitted. So Miriam tried to separate Zipporah from the camp, and God says that as punishment, Miriam herself should be separated from the camp. So it looks like God's answer was that Moses is justified and Moses is permitted to marry this woman. There is a foundation for conversion. There's a foundation for accepting the other into the midst of the Jewish people. There's a foundation for tolerance and for understanding, and not just looking at things black and white, but going a little bit deeper and understanding that there are at least some people that are very, very worthy to enter into the Jewish people, and it's an honor for Moses to marry her. It's not a matter to object to.
And what about the story of Ruth?
Same type of thing, on a certain level.
But that's before, way before.
No, that's after.
After.
No, that's after. That's at least 300 years later.
And it's interesting that that Yitro is using some of the words of Ruth. You didn't notice it? What was it? Which chapter are we on?
Yitro, you mean...
When he tells him about...
Exodus 18.
Ashuv el ami el moladati. And
Numbers 10.
Yeah.
I return to my native land.
Yeah, and it's kind of juxtaposition of the same thing.
What exactly is the Hebrew there? Ashuv el ami? What does it say?
Ami moladati.
I mean, in chapter 10 of the book of Bamidbar, verse
30.
Very nice, very nice. That would mean that Ruth is echoing some of that language. I never thought of that.
It's my disease to listen to words.
But so in the book of Ruth,
she does the opposite, but the same words.
Let's look it up. So it's a foil.
Yes.
I see. Good. That's interesting. Okay.